You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Our show features our team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. And they'll help you make the most of your money while cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. You'll get clarity on strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the history of the Second World War. On this episode of our Spanish Civil War interview series, I was joined by Jessica Thorne to discuss the treatment and experiences of prisoners during the Civil War and after. Discussing prisoners during a civil war is always interesting because their experiences are often quite different than what is experienced by more traditional prisoners of war. There was a political dimension for why they were in prison during the war and then why they were kept in prisons after the war was over, and we discussed that dimension and the consequences of it during this interview. I hope you enjoy it. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Spanish Civil War interview series. Today, I'm here with Jess Thorne, a PhD researcher with a special emphasis on anarchist prisoners in post-Civil War Spain. Jess, how's it going today?
It's going okay. I mean, 2 weeks into lockdown 2.0, which is, I'm kind of feeling the pinch now. It was a bit of a novelty. I mean, it's terrifying, but it was a novelty back in April. Also, it was kind of warm. Now it's cold and damp. And between those periods of time, I've also moved on to a barge, which is, you know, it's not like the warmest place.
Yeah, 2020 continues to be a real humdinger of a year, I think. It's a good way to describe it. But we're here to talk about sort of prisoners in post-Civil War Spain. So I'll start off with this question. So what would morph into the prison system of Francoist Spain had its roots in the Civil War? So what were conditions like for prisoners during the war? And were there any differences between those captured sort of in a military context versus those that were arrested behind the lines?
It's probably important to start briefly with the political aspirations of early Francoism and why from the beginning prison, you know, was such a key tool for the Francoist side. And perhaps we should begin by saying that, wars are never just about the occupation of a geographical national territory. They're always about social reconfiguration. And Franco's military rebels who, you know, initiated the coup back in July 1936, you know, saw themselves as defenders of an old Spain. So that was a Spain of, you know, conservative Catholic customs, feudal class relations, rigid gender norms, and a wounded but actually still governing colonial mentality, which resulted from, you know, the loss of Spanish colonies in the Americas. I mean, some scholars have argued that ultimately the Civil War was driven by conflicting visions of what post-imperial Spain could be. So this military and colonial context is really important. And it's important because those on the receiving end of Francoist repression, you know, in its prisons and in its concentration camps, would become the exact target of what French poet and politician Aimé Césaire described as colonialism come home. Now, he was talking about the rise of fascism sort of in continental Europe and specifically about more about the Nazi regime. And Spain obviously remained neutral during the First World War. It's quite, you know, it's quite different to those other examples of fascism in continental Europe. But the makeshift prison system that was constructed by the Francoist side during the Civil War, you know, a war triggered by the officers of Spain's colonial army of Africa, I think it perfectly embodied Cezanne's thesis. And, you know, Franco's system of justice was a system of military retribution. It operated within the framework, language, and mindset of a colonial occupation. Except, you know, those rounded up in the concentration camps weren't, you know, colonial subjects. They were Spanish citizens, you know, aligned with the Republic. So, I mean, by the end of the Civil War, there were around 180 concentration camps in Spain. And that's if we, you know, consider other more makeshift camps that were in operation at the time. And the conditions inside these camps and various kind of labour battalions, penal detachments were, you know, absolutely abysmal. And the results for this for many of those in the prison population were fatal. Many in the camps were subject to extrajudicial murder, i.e. they were just like simply dragged out and shot. Others, you know, thousands perished from starvation. Many internees became the victims also of tuberculosis, and you know, very few of those in these like very tough conditions survived that. In terms of distinctions between those captured in a military context and then, you know, civilians arrested behind the lines, there really wasn't any kind of meaningful divergence in terms of treatment. And I guess that's what makes the Spanish Civil War an interesting case. I mean, during the hotter period of repression, there were summary executions of both civilians and military personnel. And once the, you know, more organised so-called cold repression took root through, you know, like military tribunals and whatnot, then everything really just depended on the investigations of your past. But the important thing to grasp here is that Francoism was at war with its own society. And so its progenitors saw no meaningful distinctions between, you know, those that were aligned with the Republic, whether they were, you know, at the military level or the civilian level. They were both, you know, the enemy within.
So you mentioned forced labor as part of what was happening. Was that a pretty large factor for prisoners during and after the war?
Yeah, I mean, forced labor was significant during the Civil War. It became absolutely integral to sort of post-Civil War reconstruction. It was wrapped up in this kind of national Catholic language of like penance and atonement, and you know, the defeated would have to suffer and, you know, exploit themselves to basically rebuild the country that the Francoist rebels, you know, sort of suggested that they had destroyed, when in fact, obviously, you know, they were the ones that initiated a military coup. The system of forced labour was absolutely integral to the Franco dictatorship, and it continued, you know, for decades after the Civil War. You know, quite a few historians kind of they kind of highlight 1947 as like being the beginning of the end of the kind of concentration camp model, which is true. It is true. I mean, they're not wrong, but forced labor continues well after that. I mean, if you think of like the most famous example, which some of your listeners may be aware of because it's been in the news recently, sort of in the last year, is the mausoleum that was built for Franco, the Valley of the Fallen. That took 18 years to construct. And I think it involved somewhere around like 20,000 prisoners constructing that. And many of them died in the process, just out of, you know, malnutrition and starvation and exhaustion. But they were also involved in kind of, really important kind of national infrastructure projects, huge irrigation projects. And they were also leased out to various kind of private companies, some of which, you know, are still in existence today and haven't really had any kind of reckoning with the processes by which, you know, they've gained the wealth they have today.
So when the Civil War ended, how did these prisons and camps sort of transition into the post-war period? Was there a consolidation, an effort to make them sort of more permanent?
I mean, I could give you that there's a kind of short answer to this. I mean, I would argue that the prison system never fully transitions to like a peacetime carceral system. Obviously, there was an effort to become less dependent on concentration camps, particularly after 1945, for reasons that are quite obvious, not least of which, you know, was the alignment of Western Europe, the reconstruction of Western Europe. And, you know, concentration camps entered the kind of European imaginary as like a dividing line between sort of democracies and dictatorships. So there was an effort, at least a kind of, yeah, an outward effort for the Franco regime to kind of become less reliant on these things. I think they were aware that, you know, they were going to receive outside criticism for that. But, you know, none of this was driven by a kind of humanitarian concern or anything. And prisoners continued to be mobilized by the Militarized Penal Colony Service, which was a state body that would remain in operation up until 1959. I think it's worth saying that, you know, the concentration camps by sort of, you know, 1939, 1940 were vastly overcrowded, to the point where they were going to start to impinge on like effective forms of state building for the regime. So at the start of 1940, across like the various jails, camps and labor battalions, there were close to, scholars think, 1 million prisoners in the system, which is, you know, out of a national population of something like 27, 28 million is kind of huge. I mean, completely unprecedented in Spain. And this situation was just not sustainable for a regime that wanted to establish its fundamentalist dream of total social control. Because, I mean, whilst the concentration camps and labor battalions were miserable, they did afford prisoners more opportunities to escape. And so, for example, convicts, like, this is an anarchist who I've been reading a lot about recently, who I'm finding quite fascinating and endearing, and quite heartening in these dark times, actually, is Cipriano Damiano Gonzalez. He was a big cause for concern for the prison and security services. And the reason why I want to like briefly just discuss this story is because, you know, whilst it's incredibly heartening, it's actually not particularly remarkable. In fact, you know, he's representative of many kind of fugitive prisoners at the time. He was arrested in Alicante in 1939. And for the next decade afterwards, he basically traveled around in this like, revolving journey between concentration camps, penal colonies and prison. Now, in these years of transit, he managed to escape not just like once or twice, but 9 times. And after one of his successful breakouts, he even managed to take up a kind of state bureaucratic position under a false identity, of course, at a public works commission in Cadiz. And he would like use this clandestine outpost to give kind of false identity documents to other fugitives on the run, basically. So, I mean, initially the state's response to this kind of burgeoning crisis, not that it was considering it as a social crisis, but a crisis of the state and its control, was to, you know, relocate prisoners from the camps to smaller prisons. And they did so on overcrowded trains, often without water or food. Many of them died on the journey to the prisons. And if they didn't, many of them arrived in extremely ill health and often brought with them diseases. So what happened then is you'd have these huge fatal epidemics in the prison. I mean, some scholars estimate that at least 140,000 died in prison in the years between 1939 and 1944. So what we see in the early 1940s is certainly a slight drop off in terms of prison population numbers, But this is because of the extremely high death rates in the prison, not because the regime is evolving towards a peacetime model. I mean, where the regime actually tries to claim it has moved away from the wartime model is in relation to this completely bogus parole system that it ends up establishing. And this parole system effectively gave Franco's historic social base the power to grant and withdraw a prisoner's release. They could also rearrest them as well at any period. But within this system, the church, the army, and sort of the old clientelist networks of landowners remain permanently mobilized by the regime, you know, politically and socially. And these parole boards, they would include the prison director, the head of prison operations, the prison doctor, and the prison chaplain. Now, the board would draw up a report on the basis of the prisoner's willingness to collaborate with the regime, basically. And this report would then be sent to a committee of local kind of client groups, which would include the mayor, often the phalangist, who, you know, a member of Spain's only permitted fascist party, the police chief, and the parish priest. Now, these local boards also oversaw the private lives of prisoners' families, who they viewed with the same amount of contempt. And if an application was denied by the local board, which was often frequent, then the prison board would subject prisoners to internal exile by basically relocating them to another part of the country, often, you know, hundreds of miles away from the family networks. So the appearance of this regulated parole system, which many of your listeners would probably associate with, you know, criminal justice systems under liberal democracies, belied the fact that this was about, you know, extending control outside of the prison walls and extending the prison as a space, kind of, in this quite kind of, I guess, like Foucauldian way. So for many of the prisoners at the receiving end of this, like, really cruel and repressive bureaucracy, this was felt as the continuation of the war by other means. And these incursions by the regime on ex-prisoners occurred, you know, day in and day out. I mean, any economic activity, any migratory movements from province to province, even applications for a driving license, all of these things required the permission of the local dignitaries. And they were often embittered and still hadn't got over the kind of the experience of the 1930s. So, I mean, for me, this is important because it really challenges sort of really those really truncated views of the Franco dictatorship, which you see in a lot of Anglo-American historiography, which suggests that after the battlefield war, Francoism evolved into this kind of just like a mere authoritarian regime. Like all the totalitarian fascist influences just kind of like faded away naturally, kind of thing. Whereas, you know, I think if you look at the prison system, you can see there's constant mobilization here. Certainly not, it certainly hasn't demobilized as a society at this point.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
Hey there, I'm Dylan Lewis, one of the hosts of Motley Fool Money. Each weekday on Motley Fool Money, we talk through the business news you need to know and the stories moving stocks on Wall Street. On weekends, we dive into the industries shaping tomorrow and host the experts, authors, and executives that understand them. Tune in for insights, a long-term perspective on investing, and of course, stock ideas, plenty of them. To quote a listener, it pays to listen. Check us out and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
In the years after 1938, 1939, like, there's all these people in these prisons, and, like, What was the end goal of this imprisonment? Was it just like, okay, you were an enemy, we're going to continue your punishment until you die, for a lot of them, or was there like political re-education happening with the idea of, you know, letting them re-enter society? What was the end goal?
I mean, yeah, so you're right. I mean, despite there being, you know, really high mortality rates in Franco's prisons, there was an end goal. And, you know, prisons were, in the legal language of the regime, they were designated as these sites of spiritual redemption. And in Franco's own words, literally his own words, not the most compelling or articulate writer, I have to say. He says, there were two types of prisoners. There were, and you know, this is a direct quote, compulsive criminals with no possible redemption within the human order, and those capable of sincere repentance, therefore redeemable and adaptable to the social life of patriotism. So those charged on, and he makes no concession here for common and political prisoners. It's a really important point to make. Publicly, the Franco regime says it doesn't have any political prisoners, it just has a criminal population. But I mean, internally, the prison regime was organized sort of through these political common prisoner divides, and those charged on Republican sort of, they were called like blood crimes. They were to be held in these central prisons for social political crimes, where supposedly they could receive a greater range of treatment. And these separate prisons were to be used as sites for what the regime called moral education, which would be achieved through catechetical labor and religious instruction. So in short, spiritual redemption would be achieved through work. Work and religious instruction were the two key components of political re-education. Indeed, work was punishment for the disruption of Spain's traditional class hierarchies during the 1930s. This is what it was, you know, this is what it was all about. In the regime's view, these prisoners had essentially brought their suffering on themselves by daring to disrupt the traditional social order, an order which was now being, you know, brutally renovated and mythologized by the regime as sacred. It was a, you know, it's a sacred order now, you could not challenge it. So, I mean, at a fundamental level, this was ideological. It was about making sure that the social struggles waged by the urban and rural working classes during the years of the Republic would never re-emerge again. And, you know, on that front, it was tragically successful. I mean, the revolutionary demands of workers would not and have not reached the same scale or force since, I guess. But in the short term, you know, forced labour brought the regime enormous economic benefit. For decades after the Civil War, you know, prisoners were leased out to these private companies, as I already mentioned, and these various public work commissions. What little wages the prisoner did receive, and they did receive some, they did receive sort of meager wages. I think it was around half the wage of a free worker, but it could be possibly even less than that. Well, most of that would be deducted to finance the prison system and pay for like maintenance accommodation costs.
Of course.
I guess what a really interesting example in terms of like how the Franco regime envisioned punishment and sort of its criminological thinking was, it constructed this massive new prison in 1944 and 1945 on the outskirts of Madrid called Carabanchel. And it was a mixture, it was kind of like a classic panopticon structure, you know, like modelled off Jeremy Bentham's panopticon. But it had this like really curious mixture of kind of like high Catholic imagery and a kind of Greco-Roman neoclassicist style. I mean, it's almost the sort of thing you could see appearing in kind of Mussolini's Italy. And again, that was something where, you know, prisoners worked on constructing that as well. So, I mean, the end goal in terms of like, why was work sort of a route for redemption? Well, obviously it was kind of like, it was fortuitous for the state. But also it was to kind of reconfigure the defeated, who were seen as like kind of a feckless working class poor, as these kind of like disciplined, kind of militarized workers. That's what they wanted to do. But they did make a distinction slightly, well, quite importantly, between, you know, political prisoners and common prisoners. Many of the common prisoners were actually seen as like redeemable. They were redeemable kind of criminals. Some of the political prisoners were not, they just weren't seen as redeemable, and therefore they were denied work, which made their experience in prison really hard, because they were just getting nothing and they relied totally on outside support. And if they didn't have that, then they would really, you know, really, really struggle to survive. So yeah, I mean, there was the end goal was to reform the prisoner, but to do so politically, you know.
And so you mentioned a few times about sort of international reaction to this. So obviously in 1939, an event starts that diverts some attention to other events in Europe. But what was the sort of international response to the conditions experienced by these prisoners in Spain? Like, did they even really know what was happening outside of Spain?
It's interesting. So, I mean, a lot of my work has focused on the international response to the situation of political prisoners in Spain more after the Second World War. But I have come across British diplomatic reports sort of during the Second World War, which, you know, they do suggest that they were perfectly aware of the extent to which, you know, the Franco regime was borrowing its criminological and sort of penitentiary thinking from sort of Nazi Germany. And just in case any of the listeners don't know, Franco's political police, who were the equivalent of the British special branch, I guess, were physically trained by the Gestapo, and then later by the CIA after that. So, I mean, immediately after the war, the Second World War, the Franco regime had to deal with various diplomatic and trade embargoes. It was incredibly isolated at this point. But from 1947 onwards, the international position of the regime started to shift, and it started to shift rapidly and dramatically. In 1951, embargoes ended almost across the board. A year later, Spain was admitted to UNESCO. And in 1953, the regime received key financial and military support from the US, which was known as the Madrid Pact. In fact, once Franco received that, I'm not sure if it was directly at the time or a few years later, but he was quoted saying, "At last, I have won the civil war." So he, you know, being accepted into like the new democratic order was like him, you know, saying, "Okay, I'm here to stay. I'm not going to be, you know, militarily overthrown or anything." So this closer allied alignment with Franco was driven by, you know, his classic kind of interwar fears of Bolshevism that had reemerged with the onset of the Cold War. And subsequent fears of Soviet expansion had a real devastating impact on the anti-Franco position. I mean, it's often missed in the post-war sort of European historiography, but I mean, we could really talk about Spain sort of in the post-1945 period, particularly by sort of the mid-1950s, as a kind of Western client regime at this period. But there is actually a really interesting case, which we could talk about, of where international scrutiny was applied to Franco's prisons. So in 1952, this sort of NGO type body called the International Commission Against Concentration Camp Regimes, which had been it basically been set up by this sort of ex-Trotskyist in France called David Rousseau, and he, you know, was basically trying to investigate the situation in Soviet Russia and the vast, you know, concentration of gulag labor camps there. But they decided also to conduct on-site investigations in Spain. And they visited, I think it was 17 prisons, I think like, four or five labor battalions and one militarized penal colony. So it's quite comprehensive. It was a comprehensive sort of survey. Now, the commission was formed basically of like Nazi camp survivors and ex-resistors. And with the Nazi SS camp setting the benchmark, the purpose of the Spanish visit was to determine whether Franco's carceral system constituted a concentrationary regime. Now, publicly, this commission viewed their task of investigating camp systems around the world as an apolitical one. But from the beginning, the overarching focus of the commission was on exposing similarities between Hitler's atrocities and, as I said, the Gulag labor camps in Soviet Russia. But this commission came to really ambivalent conclusions about Franco's prisons. So the report stated that between 1938 and 1939, and 1945 to 1946, Franco's camp system could be compared with the German regime. But on the question of whether Franco's prisons constituted a concentrationary regime in 1952, the commission presented a negative verdict. And it said no case reproduced the conditions obtaining in Hitler's concentration camps. And in the Betim institutions, the conditions were the same as may be found in well-developed penitentiary systems devised for ordinary criminals. Now, you know, it's a discussion to be had here about all the various kinds of stagecraft the prison authorities were able to put in place before the commission arrived, which I found, you know, it was kind of extensive based on the letters that prisoners subsequently smuggled out when they heard about the kind of conclusions of the report. And I mean, it wasn't kind of... It didn't let the Franco regime off the hook, saying it wasn't as bad as the Nazi concentration camps.
It's a very low bar.
Yeah, it's a very low bar, isn't it? Yeah. You know, the assessment of the post-1948 prison system allowed the regime to justify its pre-1945 state of affairs as this, like, necessary state of emergency because it was a war situation. And in the end, the commission report really ran out of momentum and it was kind of hamstrung by its own metric, i.e., you know, the rigid comparison with the Nazi camps, which, you know, as I said, is a pretty poor threshold for assessing state violence. I mean, other concerns, interestingly, such as the use of forced labour, which were brought up in the report, I mean, they were kind of controversial because they opened the door to embarrassing claims on the issue of work brigade conscription in Western colonies. So no one kind of wanted to pursue this. There wasn't like the kind of the political climate to pursue this at this period. I mean, the Cold War really squandered any kind of international meaningful response.
Yeah, it sounds a lot like Franco and his regime was able to hide behind the "I really hate communists" sort of shield.
I mean, he was publicly quite happy. I mean, the regime were publicly quite happy to say that, you know, we have like Marx, we call them like Marxist hordes in our prison system. And they were like, we're like a key ally in the fight against international communism. They used the opportunity, you know, incredibly strategically, and, you know, were quite successful.
So, the Franco regime lasts until 1975. Was there any sort of evolution of the situation within the prison system, sort of up to that point?
I mean, I think what underwent the biggest change in the decades after the Civil War was really the composition of the prison population and its size. So the statistics are incredibly sketchy, but what we do see, at least up until the late 1960s, 1970s, is the decline of political prisoners and a surge of so-called common criminals entering the system. But I mean, in the harsh autarkic world of early Francoism, like, crimes of a social, common or political nature were often like really impossible to distinguish, and it wasn't helped by the Franco regime claiming it had, you know, no political prisoners at all. And what we see in Spain is, you know, in the 1950s is an economic system which froze wage levels, it rationed food at bare subsistence levels, you know, uprooted rural labourers, all whilst dramatically increasing the cost of living. Many Spaniards had no choice actually but to take the law into their own hands if they wanted to survive. And a black market economy flourished in post-war Spain. Its commanding heights, its regime-connected clientels were protected, of course, but at the same time, subsistence-related crimes, so over like usually over incredibly minor items of property or access to food, constituted most of the petty criminal charges during the 1940s and into the 1950s. I mean, in 1957, according to an official report, which, as I said, are sketchy and usually kind of kind of vast underestimates of how many prisons there actually were, out of a total prison population of just over 18,000, there were over 7,000 prisoners arrested and charged for property crimes. Now, this wasn't only a result of, you know, the economic rupture caused by the war. I mean, autarky, so, and what obviously what I mean by that is a fully closed national economy, an isolationist economy, was also used politically by the Franco dictatorship with hunger and poverty for poorer sectors of the population. But, you know, it also meant substantial numbers among the urban sort of lower middle classes as well, becoming the means by which the state taught those it deemed hostile sectors of the population the lessons of their defeat. And it really pushed them to the margins of political life and into prison. Now, in 1959, the Franco regime abandons autarky and it adopts what is called the stabilization plan. And this opens up Spain to the free market and foreign investment and commerce. And from then on, what we see in Spain is actually a very early form. I always find this quite interesting because, you know, so many scholars always kind of look towards the example of Chile and Allende and the kind of repression over there as like that kind of experiment in like neoliberalism. But actually, what we see in Spain from like 1959 onwards is a very early form of neoliberal development. Now, some historians imply that as a result of this economic shift, the enduring fascist influences underpinning Francoism were just kind of shafted by the liberalizing motives of the free market. But as soon as you like kind of peel back this kind of consumerist gloss of the dictatorship in the 60s, it just doesn't match the empirical reality on the ground. It's still an incredibly violent and difficult situation for those that are kind of constitute the defeated sectors in Spain. I mean, in the early 1960s, Franco's vertical and state-controlled trade unions did devolve some workplace wage agreements, which came as part of this kind of 1958 law of collective bargaining. But they were purely an economistic measure in the service of structural adjustment. And, you know, when workers threatened to break out of the regime's vertical arrangements, as they did in sort of 67-68, echoing, you know, the political mobilization of workers elsewhere in Europe at the time, particularly France, neighboring France, the Franco regime, you know, panicked and declared a state of emergency. And it's like, right, we need to domesticate the working class again. They've got out of hand. And it's like, right, we're in a state of war again. So in fact, from the regime's declaration of a state of exception in 1969 until the death of Franco in November 1975, more deaths occurred in strikes and protest actions than throughout the whole preceding part of the 1960s. And I mean, inside the prisons themselves, there was just no overhaul in terms of staff personnel. Many were still sort of drawn from quarters of the army that were dominated by the Falange, you know, Spain's fascist and only permissive political party. One former prison officer, actually, who worked in Carabanchel throughout most of the 1970s, he was interviewed recently for a film, and he said something like, kind of, it's kind of just really chilling, actually. And it just shows how Francoism had pervaded internal prison culture from the top down. And he said, I'm quoting this, "We were kind of a militarized squad. In fact, when we started, they gave us a weapon. We couldn't technically use it inside the prison, but nevertheless, we had it. In fact, we started to have problems when we refused to take the weapon. They started to call us Democrats, communists, socialists. That was the way to insult us." So, you know, I kind of want to re-emphasize this point, I guess, that I made quite a lot sort of throughout discussing this with you, is that, you know, this wasn't a kind of stuffy, politically demobilized autocracy. as you know, some historians have implied, its visible and brutal origins were always there. And its fascist influences endured, and you know, in its death throes in these sort of latter years of the 1970s, you know, it violently came to the surface.
Thank you for joining me here to talk about this topic. It's been really interesting.
Great. Yeah, I've enjoyed it. It's been a useful tool for me, I think. It's a kind of duly novel experience because I haven't done a podcast before and I haven't done a podcast on a boat. So there we go.